He himself had barely finished the second year of vocational school when he had had to go to work. But if he had been able to study as his son was doing, who knows where he might have gone? And he concluded, "Study, Nino. Go on, make Papa proud, and do what I was unable to do." That tone bothered Nino more than anything else. Sometimes, just to get away, he went so far as to invite Marisa and me to go out with him. He would say gloomily to his parents, as if we had been tormenting him, "They want to get an ice cream. They want to go for a little walk. I'll take them." Marisa hurried eagerly to get ready, and I regretted that I always had the same shabby old dress. But it seemed to me that he didn't much care if I was pretty or ugly. As soon as we left the house, he started talking, which made Marisa uncomfortable. She said it would have been better for her to stay home. I, however, hung on Nino's every word. It greatly astonished me that, in the tumult of the port, among the young and not-so-young men who looked at Marisa and me purposefully, he showed not a trace of that disposition to violence that Pasquale, Reno, Antonio, Enzo showed when they went out with us and someone gave us one glance too many. As an intimidating guardian of our bodies, he had little value. Maybe because he was engrossed in the things that were going on in his head, by an eagerness to talk to me about them, he would let anything happen to us. That was how Marisa made friends with some boys from Forio. They came to see her at Barano, and she brought them with us to the beach at the Maronti. And so the three of us began to go out every evening. We all went to the port, but once we arrived, she went off with her new friends. When in the world would Pasquale have been so free with Carmela, Antonio with Ada? And we walked along the sea. Then we met her around 10. And returned home. One evening, as soon as we were alone, Nino said suddenly that as a boy, he had greatly envied the relationship between Lila and me. He saw us from a distance, always together, always talking, and he would have liked to be friends with us, but never had the courage. Then he smiled and said, "You remember the declaration I made to you?" "Yes. I liked you a lot." I blushed. I whispered stupidly, "Thank you." "I thought we would become engaged, and we would all three be together forever. You, me, and your friend." "Together?" He smiled at himself as a child. I didn't understand anything about engagements. Then he asked me about Lila. "Did she go on studying?" "No." "What does she do?" "She helps her parents." "She was so smart. You couldn't keep up with her. She made my head a blur." He said it just that way. "She made my head a blur." And if at first I had been a little disappointed because he had said that his declaration of love had been only an attempt to introduce himself into my and Leela's relationship, this time I suffered in an obvious way. I felt a real pain in my chest. "She's not like that anymore," I said. "She's changed." And I felt an urge to add, "Have you heard how the teachers at school talk about me?" Luckily, I managed to restrain myself. But after that conversation, I stopped writing to Lila. I had trouble telling her what was happening to me. And anyway, she wouldn't answer. I devoted myself instead to taking care of Nino. I knew that he woke up late, and I invented excuses of every sort not to have breakfast with the others. I waited for him. I went to the beach with him. I got his things ready. I carried them. We went swimming together. But when he went out to sea, I didn't feel able to follow. I returned to the shoreline to watch, apprehensively, the wake he left, the dark speck of his head. I became anxious if I lost him. I was happy when I saw him return. In other words, I loved him and knew it and was content to love him. But meanwhile, the mid-August holiday approached. One evening I told him that I didn't want to go to the port. I would rather walk to the Maronti. There was a full moon. I hoped that he would come with me, rather than take his sister, who was eager to go to the port, where by now she had a sort of boyfriend, with whom, she told me, she exchanged kisses and embraces, betraying the boyfriend in Naples. Instead, he went with Marisa. As a matter of principle, I set out on the rocky road that led to the beach. The sand was cold, gray-black in the moonlight. The sea scarcely breathed. There was not a living soul, and I began to weep with loneliness. What was I? Who was I? I felt pretty again. My pimples were gone. The sun and the sea had made me slimmer. And yet the person I liked, and whom I wished to be liked by, showed no interest in me. What signs did I carry? What fate? I thought of the neighborhood as of a whirlpool, from which any attempt at escape was an illusion. Then I heard the rustle of sand. I turned. I saw the shadow of Nino. He sat down beside me. He had to go back and get his sister in an hour. I felt he was nervous. He was hitting the sand with the heel of his left foot. He didn't talk about books. He began suddenly speaking of his father. "I will devote my life," he said, as if he were speaking of a mission, "to trying not to resemble him." "He's a nice man." "Everyone says that."
"And so?"
He had a sarcastic expression that for a few seconds made him ugly. "How is Milena?"
I looked at him in astonishment.
I had been very careful never to mention Milena in those days of intense conversation, and here he was talking about her.
"All right."
"He was her lover. He knew perfectly well that she was a fragile woman, but he took her just the same, out of pure vanity. Out of vanity he would hurt anyone and never feel responsible. Since he is convinced that he makes everyone happy, he thinks that everything is forgiven him. He goes to Mass every Sunday. He treats us children with respect. He is always considerate of my mother. But he betrays her continually. He's a hypocrite. He makes me sick." I didn't know what to say. In the neighborhood, terrible things could happen. Fathers and sons often came to blows, like Reno and Fernando, for example. But the violence of those few carefully constructed sentences hurt me. Nino hated his father with all his strength. That was why he talked so much about the Karamazovs. But that wasn't the point. What disturbed me profoundly was that Donato Saratore, as far as I had seen with my own eyes, heard with my own ears, was not repellent. He was the father that every girl, every boy should want, and Marisa, in fact, adored him. Besides, if his sin was the capacity to love, I didn't see anything particularly evil. Even of my father, my mother would say angrily, who knows what he had been up to? As a result, those lashing phrases, that cutting tone, seemed to me terrible. I murmured, "He and Milena were overcome by passion, like Dido and Aeneas. These are things that are hurtful, but also very moving."
"He swore faithfulness to my mother before God," he exclaimed suddenly. "He doesn't respect her or God."
And he jumped up in agitation. His eyes were beautiful, shining.
"Not even you understand me," he said, walking off with long strides.
I caught up to him, my heart pounding.
"I understand you,"
I murmured, and cautiously took his arm.
We had scarcely touched. The contact burned my fingers. I immediately let go. He bent over and kissed me on the lips, a very light kiss.
"I'm leaving tomorrow," he said.
"But the 13th is the day after tomorrow." He didn't answer. We went back to Barano, speaking of books. Then we went to get Marisa at the port. I felt his mouth on mine. 33. I cried all night, in the silent kitchen. I fell asleep at dawn. Nella came to wake me and reproached me. She said that Nino had wanted to have breakfast on the terrace in order not to disturb me. He had left. I dressed in a hurry, and she saw that I was suffering. "Go on," she yielded, finally. "Maybe you'll be in time." I ran to the port, hoping to get there before the ferry left, but the boat was already out at sea. Some difficult days passed. Cleaning the rooms, I found a blue paper bookmark that belonged to Nino, and I hid it among my things. At night, in my bed in the kitchen, I sniffed it, kissed it, licked it with the tip of my tongue, and cried. My own desperate passion moved me, and my weeping fed on itself. Then Donato Savatori arrived for his 2-week holiday. He was sorry that his son had left, but pleased that he had joined his schoolmates in the Avellinese to study. "He's a truly serious boy," he said to me, "like you. I'm proud of him, as I imagine your father must be proud of you." The presence of that reassuring man calmed me. He wanted to meet Marisa's new friends. He invited them one evening to have a big bonfire on the beach. He himself gathered all the wood he could find and piled it up, and he stayed with us until late. The boy with whom Marisa was carrying on a half-steady relationship strummed a guitar, and Donato sang. He had a beautiful voice. Then, late at night, he himself began to play, and he played well. He improvised dance tunes. Some began to dance, Marisa first. I looked at that man and thought, he and his son have not even a feature in common. Nino is tall, he has a delicate face, the forehead buried under black hair, the mouth always half-closed, with inviting lips. Donato, instead, is of average height. His features are pronounced. He has a receding hairline. His mouth is compact, almost without lips. Nino has brooding eyes that see beyond things and persons and seem to be frightened. Donato has a gaze that is always receptive, that adores the appearance of every thing or person and is always smiling on them. Nino has something that's eating him inside, like Leela, and it's a gift and a suffering. They aren't content. They never give in. They fear what is happening around them. This man, no. He appears to love every manifestation of life, as if every lived second had an absolute clarity. From that evening on, Nino's father seemed to me a solid remedy, not only against the darkness into which his son had driven me, departing after an almost imperceptible kiss, but also, I realized with amazement, against the darkness into which Leela had driven me by never responding to my letters. She and Nino scarcely know each other, I thought. They have never been friends, and yet now they seem to me very similar. They have no need of anything or anyone, and they always know what's right and what isn't. But if they're wrong? What is especially terrible about Marcello Solara? What is especially terrible about Donato Savatore? I didn't understand. I loved both Leela and Nino, and now, in a different way, I missed them. But I was grateful to that hated father, who made me and all us children important, who gave us joy and peace that night at the Maronti. Suddenly, I was glad that neither of the two was present on the island. I began reading again. I wrote a last letter to Leela, in which I said that, since she hadn't ever answered me, I wouldn't write anymore. I bound myself instead to the Saratore family. I felt I was the sister of Marisa, Pinuccio, and little Ciro, who now loved me tremendously, and with me, only with me, wasn't naughty, but played happily. We went looking for shells together. Lydia, whose hostility had conclusively turned into sympathy and fondness, often praised me for the precision that I put into everything, setting the table, cleaning the rooms, washing the dishes, entertaining the baby, reading and studying. One morning, she made me try on a sundress that was too tight for her, and, since Nella and even Saratore, called urgently to give an opinion, thought it very becoming, she gave it to me. At certain moments, she even seemed to prefer me to Marisa. She said, "She's lazy and vain. I brought her up badly. She doesn't study. Whereas you are so sensible about everything." "Just like Nino," she added once, "except that you're sunny, and he is always irritable." But Donato, hearing those criticisms, responded sharply and began to praise his oldest son. "He's as good as gold," he said, and with a look asked me for confirmation, and I nodded yes with great conviction. After his long swims, Donato lay beside me to dry in the sun and read his newspaper, Roma, the only thing he read. I was struck by the fact that someone who wrote poems, who had even collected them in a volume, never opened a book. He hadn't brought any with him, and was never curious about mine. At times, he read aloud to me some passages from an article, words and sentiments that would have made Pasquale extremely angry, and certainly Professor Galliani, too. But I was silent. I didn't feel like arguing with such a kind and courteous person, and spoiling the great esteem he had for me. Once he read me an entire article, from beginning to end, and every two lines he turned to Lydia, smiling, and Lydia responded with a complicit smile. At the end he asked me, "Did you like it?" It was an article on the speed of train travel, as opposed to the speed of travel in the past, by horse carriage or on foot along country lanes. It was written in high-flown sentences that he read with great feeling. "Yes, very much," I said.
"See who wrote it. What do you read here?"
He held it out toward me, put the paper under my eyes. With emotion, I read, "Donato Saratore." Lydia burst out laughing, and so did he. They left me on the beach to keep an eye on Ciro while they swam in their usual way, staying close to each other and whispering. I looked at them. I thought, poor Melina, but without bitterness toward Saratore. Assuming that Nino was right and that there really had been something between the two of them. Assuming, in other words, that Saratore really had betrayed Lydia, now, even more than before, now that I knew him somewhat. I couldn't feel that he was guilty, especially since it seemed to me that not even his wife felt he was guilty, although at the time she had compelled him to leave the neighborhood. As for Melina, I understood her too. She had felt the joy of love for that so far from ordinary man, a conductor on the railroad, but also a poet, a journalist, and her fragile mind had been unable to readjust to the rough normality of life without him. I was satisfied with these thoughts. I was pleased with everything in those days, with my love for Nino, with my sadness, with the affection that I felt surrounded by, with my own capacity to read, think, reflect in solitude. 34. Then, at the end of August, when that extraordinary period was about to come to an end, two important things happened, suddenly, on the same day. It was the 25th. I remember with precision because my birthday fell on that day. I got up. I prepared breakfast for everyone. At the table, I said, "Today I'm 15." And as I said it, I remembered that Leela had turned 15 on the 11th, but, in the grip of so many emotions, I hadn't remembered. Although customarily it was the Saints' Day that was celebrated, birthdays were considered irrelevant at the time, the Saratores and Nella insisted on having a party in the evening. I was pleased. They went to get ready for the beach. I began to clear the table when the postman arrived. I stuck my head out the window. The postman said there was a letter for Greco. I ran down with my heart pounding. I ruled out the possibility that my parents had written to me. Was it a letter from Leela? From Nino? It was from Leela. I tore open the envelope. There were 5 closely written pages, and I devoured them. But I understood almost nothing of what I read. It may seem strange today, and yet it really was so. Even before I was overwhelmed by the contents, what struck me was that the writing contained Leela's voice. Not only that. From the first lines, I thought of the Blue Fairy, the only text of hers that I had read, apart from our elementary school homework. And I understood what, at the time, I had liked so much. There was, in the Blue Fairy, the same quality that struck me now. Leela was able to speak through writing, unlike me when I wrote, unlike Saratore in his articles and poems, unlike even many writers I had read and was reading. She expressed herself in sentences that were well constructed and without error, even though she had stopped going to school. But, further, she left no trace of effort. You weren't aware of the artifice of the written word. I read and I saw her. I heard her. The voice set in the writing overwhelmed me, enthralled me even more than when we talked face to face. It was completely cleansed of the dross of speech, of the confusion of the oral. It had the vivid orderliness that I imagined would belong to conversation if one were so fortunate as to be born from the head of Zeus, and not from the Grecos, the Cerulos. I was ashamed of the childish pages I had written to her, the overwrought tone, the frivolity, the false cheer, the false grief. Who knows what Leela had thought of me? I felt contempt and bitterness toward Professor Geraci, who had deluded me by giving me a 9 in Italian. The first effect of that letter was to make me feel, at the age of 15, on the day of my birthday, a fraud. School, with me, had made a mistake, and proof was there, in Leela's letter. Then, slowly, the contents reached me as well. Leela sent me good wishes for my birthday. She hadn't written because she was pleased that I was having fun in the sun, that I was comfortable with the Saratores, that I loved Nino, that I liked Ischia so much, the beach of the Meronti, and she didn't want to spoil my vacation with her terrible stories. But now she had felt an urge to break the silence. Immediately after my departure, Marcello Solara, with the consent of Fernando, had begun to appear at dinner every night. He came at 8:30 and left exactly at 10:30. He always brought something, pastries, chocolates, sugar, coffee. She didn't touch anything. She kept him at a distance. He looked at her in silence. After the first week of that torture, since Leela acted as if he weren't there, he had decided to surprise her. He showed up in the morning with a big fellow, all sweaty, who deposited in the living room an enormous cardboard box. Out of the box emerged an object that we all knew about, but that very few in the neighborhood had in their house. A television. An apparatus, that is, with a screen on which one saw images, just as at the cinema. But the images came not from a projector, but rather from the air. And inside the apparatus was a mysterious tube that was called a cathode. Because of that tube, mentioned continuously by the large sweaty man, the machine hadn't worked for days. Then, after various attempts, it had started. And now half the neighborhood, including my mother, my father, and my sister and brothers, came to the Cerullo house to see the miracle. Not Reno. He was better. The fever had definitely gone. But he no longer spoke to Marcello. When Marcello showed up, he began to disparage the television. And after a while, he either went to bed without eating, or went out and wandered around with Pasquale and Antonio until late at night. Lila said that she herself loved the television. She especially liked to watch it with Melina, who came every night and sat silently for a long time, completely absorbed. It was the only moment of peace. Otherwise, everyone's anger was unloaded on her. Her brother's anger because she had abandoned him to his fate as the slave of their father, while she set off on a marriage that would make her a lady. The anger of Fernando and Nunzia because she was not nice to Solara, but rather treated him like dirt. Finally, the anger of Marcello, who, although she hadn't accepted him, felt increasingly that he was her fiancé, in fact her master, and tended to pass from silent devotion to attempts to kiss her, to suspicious questions about where she went during the day, whom she saw, if she had had other boyfriends, if she had even just touched anyone. Since she wouldn't answer, or worse still, teased him by telling him of kisses and embraces with non-existent boyfriends, he one evening had whispered to her seriously, "You tease me, but remember when you threatened me with the knife? Well, if I find out that you like someone else, remember, I won't merely threaten you, I'll kill you." So she didn't know how to get out of this situation, and she still carried her weapon, just in case. But she was terrified. She wrote, in the last pages, of feeling all the evil of the neighborhood around her. Rather, she wrote obscurely, good and evil are mixed together and reinforce each other in turn. Marcello, if you thought about it, was really a good arrangement. But the good tasted of the bad, and the bad tasted of the good. It was a mixture that took your breath away. A few evenings earlier, something had happened that had really scared her. Marcello had left, the television was off, the house was empty, Reno was out, her parents were going to bed. She was alone in the kitchen, washing the dishes, and was tired, really without energy, when there was an explosion. She had turned suddenly and realized that the big copper pot had exploded. Like that, by itself. It was hanging on the nail where it normally hung, but in the middle there was a large hole, and the rim was lifted and twisted, and the pot itself was all deformed, as if it could no longer maintain its appearance as a pot. Her mother had hurried in her nightgown and had blamed her for dropping it and ruining it. But a copper pot, even if you drop it, doesn't break and doesn't become misshapen like that. "It's this sort of thing," Lila concluded, "that frightens me. More than Marcello, more than anyone. And I feel that I have to find a solution. Otherwise, everything, one thing after another, will break. Everything. Everything." She sent me many more good wishes, and even if she wished the opposite, even if she couldn't wait to see me, even if she urgently needed my help, She hoped I would stay in Ischia with kind Signora Nella and never return to the neighborhood again.
35. This letter disturbed me greatly. Leela's world, as usual, rapidly superimposed itself on mine. Everything that I had written in July and August seemed to me trivial. I was seized by a frenzy to redeem myself. I didn't go to the beach. I tried immediately to answer her with a serious letter, one that had the essential, pure, yet colloquial tone of hers. But if the other letters had come easily to me, I dashed off pages and pages in a few minutes without ever correcting. This I wrote, rewrote, rewrote again. And yet Nino's hatred of his father, the role that the affair of Milena had had in the origin of that ugly sentiment, my entire relationship with the Sartori family, even my anxiety about what was happening to her, came out badly. Donato, who in reality was a remarkable man, on the page became a banal family man. And as far as Marcello was concerned, I was capable only of superficial advice. In the end, all that seemed true was my disappointment that she had a television at home, and I didn't. In other words, I couldn't answer her, even though I deprived myself of the sea, the sun, the pleasure of being with Ciro, with Pino, with Clelia, with Lydia, with Marisa, with Sartori. Thankfully, Nella at some point came to keep me company on the terrace, bringing me an orzada. And when the Sartores came back from the beach, they were sorry that I had stayed home and began celebrating me again. Lydia herself wanted to make a cake filled with pastry cream. Nella opened a bottle of vermouth. Donato Sartore began singing Neapolitan songs. Marisa gave me an oakum seahorse she had bought at the port the night before. I grew calmer, yet I couldn't get out of my mind Leela in trouble while I was so well, so celebrated. I said, in a slightly dramatic way, that I had received a letter from a friend, that my friend needed me, and so I was thinking of leaving before the appointed time. The day after tomorrow at the latest, I announced, but without really believing it. In fact, I said it only to hear Nella say how sorry she was, Lydia how Ciro would suffer, Marisa how desperate she would be, and Sartori exclaim sadly, "How will we manage without you?" All this moved me, making my birthday even happier. Then Pino and Ciro began to nod, and Lydia and Donato took them to bed. Marisa helped me wash the dishes. Nella said that if I wanted to sleep a little later in the morning, she would get up to make breakfast. I protested. That was my job. One by one they withdrew, and I was alone. I made my bed in the usual corner. I looked around to see if there were cockroaches, if there were mosquitoes. My gaze fell on the copper pots. How evocative Leela's writing was. I looked at the pots with increasing distress. I remembered that she had always liked their brilliance. When she washed them, she took great care in polishing them. On them, not coincidentally, 4 years earlier, she had placed the blood that spurted from the neck of Don Achille when he was stabbed. On them now, she had deposited that sensation of threat, the anguish over the difficult choice she had, making one of them explode like a sign, as if its shape had decided abruptly to seed. Would I know how to imagine those things without her? Would I know how to give life to every object, let it bend in unison with mine? I turned off the light. I got undressed and got in bed with Leela's letter and Nino's blue bookmark, which seemed to me at that moment the most precious things that I possessed. From the window, the white light of the moon rained down. I kissed the bookmark as I did every night.
I tried to reread my friend's letter in the weak glow. The pots shone, the table creaked, the ceiling weighed oppressively, the night air and the sea pressed on the walls. Again, I felt humbled by Leela's ability to write, by what she was able to give form to, and I was not. My eyes misted. I was happy, yes, that she was so good even without school, without books from the library. But that happiness made me guiltily unhappy. Then I heard footsteps. I saw the shadow of Saratore enter the kitchen, barefoot, in blue pajamas. I pulled up the sheet. He went to the tap. He took a glass of water, drank. He remained standing for a few seconds in front of the sink, put down the glass, moved toward my bed. He squatted beside me, his elbows resting on the edge of the sheet.
"I know you're awake," he said.
"Yes."
"Don't think of your friend. Stay."
"She's in trouble. She needs me."
"It's I who need you," he said.
And he leaned over, kissed me on the mouth without the lightness of his son, half opening my lips with his tongue. I was immobilized. He pushed the sheet aside, continued to kiss me with care, with passion, and he sought my breast with his hand. He caressed me under the nightgown. Then he let go, descended between my legs, pressed two fingers hard over my underpants. I said, did nothing. I was terrified by that behavior, by the horror it created, by the pleasure that I nevertheless felt. His mustache pricked my upper lip. His tongue was rough. Slowly he left my mouth, took away his hand.
"Tomorrow night we'll take a nice walk, you and I, on the beach," he said, a little hoarsely. "I love you, and I know that you love me very much. Isn't it true?" I said nothing. He brushed my lips again with his, murmured good night, got up, and left the kitchen. I didn't move. I don't know for how long. However I tried to distance the sensation of his tongue, his caresses, the pressure of his hand, I couldn't. Nino had wanted to warn me. Did he know what would happen? I felt an uncontainable hatred for Donato Saratore, and disgust for myself, for the pleasure that lingered in my body. However unlikely it may seem today, as long as I could remember until that night, I had never given myself pleasure. I didn't know about it. To feel it surprised me. I remained in the same position for many hours. Then, at first light, I shook myself, collected all my things, took apart the bed, wrote two lines of thanks to Nella, and left. The island was almost noiseless, the sea still. Only the smells were intense. Using the money that my mother had left me more than a month before, I took the first departing ferry. As soon as the boat moved and the island, with its tender early morning colors, was distant enough, I thought that I finally had a story to tell that Leela could not match. But I knew immediately that the disgust I felt for Saratore and the revulsion that I had toward myself would keep me from saying anything. In fact, this is the first time I've sought words for that unexpected end to my vacation. 36. I found Naples submerged in a stinking, devastating heat. My mother, without saying a word about how I had changed, the acne gone, my skin sun-darkened, reproached me because I had returned before the appointed time. "What have you done?" she said. "You've behaved rudely. Did the teacher's friend throw you out?"
It was different with my father.
whose eyes shone and who showered me with compliments, the most conspicuous of which, repeated 100 times, was, "Christ, what a pretty daughter I have." As for my siblings, they said with a certain contempt, "You look like a Negro." I looked at myself in the mirror, and I also marveled. The sun had made me a shining blonde, but my face, my arms, my legs were as if painted with dark gold. As long as I had been immersed in the colors of Ischia, amid sunburned faces, my transformation had seemed suitable. Now, restored to the context of the neighborhood, where every face, every street had a sick pallor, it seemed to me excessive, anomalous. The people, the buildings, the dusty, busy stradone had the appearance of a poorly printed photograph, like the ones in the newspapers. As soon as I could, I hurried to find Leela. I called her from the courtyard. She looked out, emerged from the doorway. She hugged me, kissed me, gave me compliments, so that I was overwhelmed by all that explicit affection. She was the same, and yet, in little more than a month, she had changed further. She seemed no longer a girl, but a woman of at least 18, an age that then seemed to me advanced. Her old clothes were short and tight, as if she had grown inside them in the space of a few minutes, and they hugged her body more than they should. She was even taller, more developed, her back was straight, and the pale face above her slender neck seemed to me to have a delicate, unusual beauty. She seemed nervous. She kept looking around on the street behind her, but she didn't explain. She said only, "Come with me," and wanted me to go with her to Stefano's grocery. She added, taking my arm, "It's something I can only do with you. Thank goodness you've come back. I thought I'd have to wait till September." We had never walked those streets toward the public gardens so close to one another, so together, so happy to see each other. She told me that things were getting worse every day. Just the night before, Marcello had arrived with sweets and spumanti, and had given her a ring studded with diamonds. She had accepted it, had put it on her finger to avoid trouble in the presence of her parents. But just before he left, at the door, she had given it back to him rudely. Marcello had protested. He had threatened her, as he now did more and more often, then had burst into tears. Fernando and Nunzia had immediately realized that something was wrong. Her mother had grown very fond of Marcello. She liked the good things he brought to the house every night. She was proud of being the owner of a television. And Fernando felt as if he had stopped suffering, because, thanks to a close relationship with the Solaras, he could look to the future without anxieties. Thus, as soon as Marcello left, both had harassed her more than usual to find out what was happening. Result, for the first time in a long, long time, Reno had defended her, had insisted that if his sister didn't want a half-wit like Marcello, it was her sacrosanct right to refuse him, and that, if they insisted on giving him to her, he, in person, would burn down everything, the house and the shoemaker's shop and himself and the entire family. Father and son had started fighting. Nunzia had got involved. All the neighbors had woken up. Not only, Reno had thrown himself on the bed in distress, had abruptly fallen asleep, and an hour later had had another episode of sleepwalking. They had found him in the kitchen lighting matches and passing them in front of the gas valve as if to check for leaks. Nunzia, terrified, had wakened Leela, saying, "Reno really does want to burn us all alive." And Leela had hurried in and reassured her mother. Reno was sleeping. And in sleep, unlike when he was awake, he wanted to make sure that there was no gas escaping. She had taken him back to bed. "I can't bear it anymore," she concluded.
You don't know what torture this is. I have to get out of this situation.
She clung to me as if I could give her the energy. You're well, she said.
Everything's going well for you. You have to help me.
I answered that she could count on me for everything, and she seemed relieved. She squeezed my arm, whispered, Look.
I saw in the distance a sort of red spot that radiated light.
What is it? Don't you see?
I couldn't see clearly.
It's Stefano's new car.
We walked to where the car was parked, in front of the grocery store, which had been enlarged, had two entrances now, and was extremely crowded. The customers, waiting to be served, threw admiring glances at that symbol of well-being and prestige. A car like that had never been seen in the neighborhood, all glass and metal, with a roof that opened. A car for wealthy people. Nothing like the Salata's 1100. I wandered around it while Leela stood in the shadows and surveyed the street as if she expected violence to erupt at any moment. Stefano looked out from the doorway of the grocery, in his greasy apron, his large head and his high forehead giving a not unpleasant sense of disproportion. He crossed the street, greeted me cordially, said, How well you look, like an actress. He too looked well. He had been in the sun as I had. Maybe we were the only ones in the whole neighborhood who appeared so healthy. I said to him, You're very dark.
I took a week's vacation.
Where?
In Ischia.
I was in Ischia too.
I know. Leela told me. I looked for you but didn't see you.
I pointed to the car. It's beautiful. Stefano's face wore an expression of moderate agreement. He said, indicating Leela with laughing eyes,
I bought it for your friend, but she won't believe it.
I looked at Leela, who was standing in the shadows, her expression serious, tense. Stefano said to her, vaguely ironic,
Now Lenutra's back. What are you doing?
Leela said, as if the thing annoyed her, Let's go. But remember, you invited her, not me. I only came along with the two of you.
He smiled and went back into the shop.
What's happening? I asked her, confused. I don't know, she said, and meant that she didn't know exactly what she was getting into. She looked the way she did when she had to do a difficult calculation in her head, but without her usual impudent expression. She was visibly preoccupied, as if she were attempting an experiment with an uncertain result. It all began, she said, with the arrival of that car. Stefano, first as if joking, then, with increasing seriousness, had sworn to her that he had bought the car for her, for the pleasure of opening the door and having her get in at least once.
It was made just for you, he had said.
And since it had been delivered at the end of July, he had been asking her constantly, not in an aggressive way, but politely, first to take a drive with him and Alfonso, then with him and Pinuccia, then even with him and his mother. But she had always said no. Finally, she had promised him, I'll go when Lenutra comes back from Ischia.
And now we were there. And what was to happen would happen.
But he knows about Marcello?
Of course he knows.
And so?
So he insists.
I'm scared, Leela. Do you remember how many things we've done that scared you? I waited for you on purpose.
Stefano returned without his apron. Dark eyes, dark face, shining black hair, white shirt and dark pants.
He opened the car door, sat behind the wheel, put the top down. I was about to get into the narrow back space, but Leela stopped me. She settled herself in the back. I sat uneasily next to Stefano. He started off immediately, heading toward the new buildings. The heat dissipated in the wind. I felt good,
intoxicated by the speed and by the tranquil certainties released by Karachi's body. It seemed to me that Leela had explained everything without explaining anything. There was, yes, this brand new sports car that had been bought solely to take her for a ride that had just begun. There was, yes, that young man who, though he knew about Marcello Solara, was violating men's rules of masculinity without any visible anxiety. There was me, yes, dragged furiously into that business to hide by my presence secret words between them, maybe even a friendship. But what type of friendship? Certainly, with that drive, something significant was happening. And yet Leela had been unable or unwilling to provide me with the elements necessary for understanding. What did she have in mind? She had to know that she was setting in motion an earthquake worse than when she threw the ink-soaked bits of paper. And yet it might be that she wasn't aiming at anything precise. She was like that. She threw things off balance just to see if she could put them back in some other way. So here we were racing along, hair blowing in the wind, Stefano driving with satisfied skill, I sitting beside him as if I were his girlfriend. I thought of how he had looked at me when he said I looked like an actress. I thought of the possibility of him liking me more than he now liked my friend. I thought with horror of the idea that Marcello Solara might shoot him. His beautiful person with its confident gestures would lose substance, like the copper of the pot that Leela had written about. We were driving among the new buildings in order to avoid passing the Bar Solara.
"I don't care if Marcello sees us," Stefano said without emphasis, "but if it matters to you, it's fine like this."
We went through the tunnel. We turned toward the marina. It was the road that Leela and I had taken many years earlier, when we had gotten caught in the rain. I mentioned that episode. She smiled. Stefano wanted us to tell him about it. We told him everything. It was fun.
And meanwhile, we arrived at the Granili. "What do you think? Fast, isn't it?"
"Incredibly fast," I said enthusiastically. Leela made no comment. She looked around. At times she touched my shoulder to point out the houses, the ragged poverty along the street, as if she saw a confirmation of something and I was supposed to understand it right away. Then she asked Stefano, seriously, without preamble, "Are you really different?" He looked at her in the rearview mirror.
"From whom?"
"You know." He didn't answer immediately. Then he said in dialect,
"Do you want me to tell you the truth?"
"Yes."
"The intention is there, but I don't know how it will end up."
At that point, I was sure that Leela must not have told me quite a few things. The elusive tone was evidence that they were close, that they had talked other times, and not in jest, but seriously. What had I missed in the period of Ischia? I turned to look at her. She delayed replying. I thought that Stefano's answer had made her nervous because of its vagueness. I saw her flooded by sunlight, eyes half closed, her shirt swelled by her breast and by the wind. "The poverty here is worse than among us," she said. And then, without connection, laughing, "Don't think I've forgotten about when you wanted to prick my tongue."
Stefano nodded. "That was another era," he said.
"Once a coward, always a coward. You were twice as big as me." He gave a small, embarrassed smile and, without answering, accelerated in the direction of the port. The drive lasted less than half an hour. We went back on the Rettifilo and Piazza Garibaldi.
"Your brother isn't well," Stefano said when we had returned to the outskirts of the neighborhood. He looked at her again in the mirror and asked, Are those shoes displayed in the window the ones you made?
What do you know about the shoes?
It's all Reno talks about.
And so?
They're very beautiful.
She narrowed her eyes, squeezed them almost until they were closed. Buy them, she said in her provocative tone.
How much will you sell them for?
Talk to my father. Stefano made a decisive U-turn that threw me against the door. We turned onto the street where the shoe repair shop was. What are you doing? Leela asked, alarmed now.
You said to buy them, and I'm going to buy them.
37. He stopped the car in front of the shoemaker's shop, came around and opened the door for me, gave me his hand to help me out. He didn't concern himself with Leela, who got out herself and stayed behind. He and I stopped in front of the window, under the eyes of Fernando and Reno, who looked at us from inside the shop with sullen curiosity. When Leela joined us, Stefano opened the door of the shop, let me go first, went in, without making way for her. He was very courteous with father and son, and asked if he could see the shoes. Reno rushed to get them, and Stefano examined them, praised them. They're light and yet strong. They really have a nice line. He asked me, what do you think, Lenu?
I said, with great embarrassment, they're very handsome.
He turned to Fernando.
Your daughter said that all three of you worked on them, and that you have a plan to make others, for women as well.
Yes, said Reno, looking in wonder at his sister.
Yes,
said Fernando, puzzled,
but not right away.
Reno said to his sister, a little worked up because he was afraid she would refuse, show him the designs. Leela, continuing to surprise him, didn't resist. She went to the back of the shop and returned, handing the sheets of paper to her brother, who gave them to Stefano. They were the models that she had designed almost 2 years earlier. Stefano showed me a drawing of a pair of women's shoes with a very high heel.
Would you buy them?
Yes. He went back to examining the designs. Then he sat down on a stool, took off his right shoe.
What size is it? 43, but it could be a 44,
Reno lied. Leela, surprising us again, knelt in front of Stefano, and using the shoehorn, helped him slip his foot into the new shoe. Then she took off the other shoe and did the same. Stefano, who until that moment had been playing the part of the practical, businesslike man, was obviously disturbed. He waited for Leela to get up, and remained seated for some seconds as if to catch his breath. Then he stood, took a few steps.
They're tight,
he said. Reno turned gray, disappointed.
We can put them on the machine and widen them,
Fernando interrupted, but uncertainly. Stefano turned to me and asked,
how do they look?
Nice, I said.
Then I'll take them.
Fernando remained impassive. Reno brightened.
You know, Ste, these are an exclusive Cerullo design. They'll be expensive.
Stefano smiled, took an affectionate tone.
And if they weren't an exclusive Cerullo design, do you think I would buy them? When will they be ready?
Reno looked at his father, radiant.
We'll keep them in the machine for at least 3 days,
Fernando said. But it was clear that he could have said 10 days, 20, a month. He was so eager to take his time in the face of this unexpected novelty.
Good. You think of a friendly price and I'll come in 3 days to pick them up.
He folded the pieces of paper with the designs and put them in his pocket before our puzzled eyes. Then he shook hands with Fernando, with Reno, and headed toward the door. The drawings, Leela said coldly.
Can I bring them back in 3 days?
Stefano asked in a cordial tone, and without waiting for an answer, opened the door. He made way for me to pass, and went out after me. I was already settled in the car next to him when Leela joined us. She was angry.
You think my father is a fool? That my brother is a fool?